enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, magazines on the Women's Hour, followed by the Center's Solutions Podcast at 11.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 52 and clear. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 10 a.m.
Yo. Here we go.
You got a marvelous vibe, and I know it starts from inside. So fill your heart with pride, and let your light shine brightly. Yo, don't hide. You're a work of art, unforgettable and off the charts.
Welcome to a podcast dedicated to your mental health.
I'm Bailey with the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hi, I'm Christy Edwards. I'm the executive director and a therapist at Centers for Children and Families.
Hi, I'm Melanie Size. I'm the marketing and development director at Centers for Children and Families.
Together, we're bringing you tips and tricks on how to navigate this thing called life. This is Center Solutions. Due to the nature of some of the topics that are discussed, listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. We are back with Center Solutions, our podcast, and this is the COVID edition, where we are bringing information about current events, not just the pandemic, but everything going on. And today with us, we have John Mark Eccles, Executive Director, and Laura Chandler, Chief Operating Officer of the Field's Edge. Welcome, you guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
This is such a wonderful topic and an important cause that you all serve. And a lot of times when we start the podcast, I'll find a little snippet of an article that's relatable, usually speaks to us in some way that has some connection to the topic. And I happened to be looking through your website, and I found a part of a blog piece that you had written, John Mark. I thought maybe you could read that for us, since
sure.
You wrote it. And this is just a little quotation that I thought was pretty powerful.
Sure, I will be happy to read it for you. In the last few months, we've begun to see our RV residents flourish. We've been learning, along with them, how they feel loved. They've been able to shed some of the protective shell they've developed while living on the streets, and the beauty of who God created them is shining through the little cracks. It's a good reminder that even the most closed-off person on the street has been designed with a desire to be fully known and fully loved. This isolation is a poignant moment for the rest of us to be empathetic to the loneliness they've experienced for long periods of their lives. In just a few weeks, I'm thirsty for connection. I miss my family. I miss gathering with believers on Sunday for worship. Without a clear end in sight, it feels like grieving something dear that I've lost, something that many of our friends on the streets lost long ago before the pandemic, if they ever had it to begin with.
Wow, that's a beautifully written and such a great example of the fact that there are people that live in our world, you know, we don't recognize it, but they are already living in this situation. I know we've talked about this with other. There are a lot of social issues that are they're being. I mean, it's on the rise now. All of our social issues, and for example, our elderly, they are also very isolated. So it's good for us to have that moment to connect. Wouldn't you say, Christy?
Oh, absolutely. I was just reading the last few sentences again to myself, and I'm like, I think that's what's going on with me, and I have the ability to get out. So some of our elderly people that are basically shut-ins, isolation is such a way of life for them, and it's made even worse because people can't even come see them. So I think that's...
Right. I mean, and we've talked about it with those with a visual impairment, too.
Yes.
So it affects a lot of people, and we're so interested in learning how our homeless population is being affected right now in our community. So it would be great if you guys would explain to us what the Fields Edge does.
Sure, I can do that. The Fields Edge, our primary mission is to cultivate home by building a permanent supportive tiny home community for the chronically homeless in Midland, Texas. And we really have been working on getting that built over the past few years. But in the meantime, we've just continued to build relationships with the homeless. We believe that the root of homelessness is really the catastrophic disconnection from family and relationship. And so our entire model is centered around rebuilding a sense of family and community and connection. So even though we don't have the village built yet, we do have the ability to carry out our mission in other ways while we're waiting for that really glorious day to open that village. We do have four neighbors that are housed in RVs right now, and we started that process towards the end of last year, and so we've walked with them through this this COVID pandemic and tried to navigate what that looks like to have people that are, you know, living in RVs and newly formerly homeless and just adjusting to what life looks like in that situation. So we have some other interesting programs. We're really really big on empowerment. And so one of our programs is a litter cleanup program with Keep Midland Beautiful and Christmas in Action that helps people to get employment from a really low barrier situation where they can go to work on our litter cleanup, pick up trash for the day, get paid, and then begin to receive case management, help getting IDs, connection to resources, and a pipeline towards housing. So that's kind of some of the things that we're up to. And in the middle of that, you know, everything, like I said, is centered around the people that we are serving and the people that we love.
Well, that's a lot. I think we always love when other organizations come and share their stories and their services with us, because a lot of times, even though we all have a general gist, we don't really get the depth of what's happening out there. And sounds like you guys are doing excellent work, and we appreciate it.
I think it would be interesting for John Mark or Laurel Wan to kind of walk us through what a tiny house would look like, especially for you know, our listeners who are visually impaired, to help them understand kind of what it, you know, because it's so compact and you have everything you need. And that's what the goal is, to try to get this village built. So could you kind of, you know, for the visually impaired, talk about what that would look like?
Sure, I can do that.
Okay.
So we, in phase one, we're starting with 10 homes, and they will be centered in a pod with the front doors facing each other and kind of a courtyard in the middle. And the idea behind that is that it forms like little tiny neighborhoods, and that's, we call our residents neighbors. Mm-hmm. And within each pod is a communal bath and kitchen facility, and then also a missional home. So there's 9 tiny houses for our neighbors that are will be formerly homeless, and then one of the houses, the missional home, is for John Mark and his family. Will live in our first pod and be our first set of missionals, and then as we grow, we'll build these pods in tens, and each pod will have a missional home with a family within the community, or missionaries that have felt the call to come and live with their families out in the community. The tiny homes for the residents or the neighbors, they will be about 200 square feet, and they have no plumbing. So they're just they're bedrooms, essentially, with a little kitchenette. And then each pod or neighborhood has a commercial kitchen and bath facility. And the idea there is that promotes community in itself within that tiny neighborhood. And then the missionals can host dinners and, you know, introduce new people, you know, coming into the neighborhood to the other neighbors, and really just facilitate community within those pods. And we had a, each house will be different. We had a competition out at the Museum of the Southwest, I believe it was last year or the year before, where architects entered in different designs, and we picked four that were really shovel ready. So we'll start with those four, but they will all be different and beautiful.
That's exciting for people just to think about, you know, ownership of that.
And whenever we have an application process, and one of the forms within that application asks things, kind of simple questions like, what's your favorite book? What's your favorite color? And the idea there is that we can, make the home really their home and how they like it and put things in there that are special to them.
Oh, what a great idea. That's very personalizing and certainly makes it special. So we're what is on everyone's mind is, how are you at the field day? How are you guys coping with what is going on right now? How are you all coping? And then tell us some things about your clients and how they're coping.
Yeah, I'll start with that. So when everything first started developing with the COVID pandemic, we really had to take a pretty hard pivot. We're in the middle, towards the end now of our capital campaign, which is very exciting. But we've been really focused on the campaign, on all of our city permitting and construction stuff, and then also on our neighbors that we've moved in. But we really had to really, respond and try to get ahead of what was coming. So we did a lot of street outreach, distributed a lot of hand sanitizer, CDC flyers, masks, really trying to educate our homeless population that are currently on the street of what was happening. Because when we first kind of went out to see, to survey the situation, we realized that most people were either unaware or just really not informed well. And so we wanted to do as much as we could to equip them, to prepare them, and to prevent the spread of COVID through the homeless population. Because in our point in time count that we do every year, there's a really high percentage of our homeless neighbors here in Midland that are in the really at-risk category. I mean, just by age, average age on the street is 55. And then you factor in just the fact that they don't sleep well and they're not receiving proper health care. And so I would say, and I think it's pretty reasonable to believe that almost all people that are currently on the street homeless are at risk, just because of the situation that they have to live in. And so we were pretty concerned. And so we tried to respond, really as much as we could. We put out some hand wash stations, in a couple locations in the city, and some porta potties, because private, restaurants and things that our people typically would use were shut down. And, we felt a little bit, you know, like we couldn't do enough. Like there was just this overarching thing that was happening, and you know, a real worry for our people that we were pretty limited on what we could do. So we did everything we could think to do, just trying to keep them safe. And I think that it helped. We'd never heard of anybody that in Midland that is homeless, or any of our neighbors that were diagnosed, and so we're very, very thankful for that.
Well, that's
wonderful. Yeah, I know early on that was some of the information that we read about or watch on television and the news, especially in larger cities like New York, how their population is affected. And it is quite frightening because it's difficult to protect people without, you know, we're all told to quarantine in our homes. Well, what do you do when you have no home?
Right. And one of the things we were trying to do in the beginning was to figure out, okay, what do we do when someone might be showing symptoms or is concerned that they might have it? And so we talked to a lot of our local health providers to see what we could do about, you know, how does, when somebody has symptoms, what are they supposed to do? You know, they can't call the hospital number. They can't go to the drive-in clinic. You know, all those options were kind of just not going to work for them. And so as we worked on those things and we're moving towards them, things started to slow down with the number of cases in Midland. And so we never really had to engage those things that we were working on. But yeah, that was definitely a real concern. Like, what happens when, you know, Joe starts getting sick and we think he has it? Like, what do we do?
Yeah, those are scary things that there are no easy answers for.
Mm.
So reaching out was a good idea.
Absolutely. Christy always talks about the importance of preparedness and how that helps with that's a good coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much uncertainty for all of us right now. We don't know. And I don't know how our statistics are right now with our homeless population. Do you have any information? Have we seen a rise since things have changed in our economy here?
Yeah, we haven't done any official counts since January, and our number was 227 total, and that includes the number of homeless people both unsheltered on the street and in our shelters and temporary housing. A pretty close to about 100 actually on the street right now, and just in our interaction and experience being out in the middle of all this, and we really kind of had to go into overdrive during this. So we've been working hard and finally getting a little bit of respite. But we really did see a lot of increase in the number of people that we had never seen before. I think a lot of that was coming from those that were just kind of on the edge, maybe living in weekly motels and weren't able to make ends meet for the week and ended up on the street. And so there was one day I was out and met 10 new people that I'd never seen before. And that was pretty frightening to think about. If that was a trend, that would be really, really concerning. But it did slow down a bit. We have seen more people, but the nature of homelessness in Midland is really interesting because people are really spread out and scattered. And so it's kind of hard to keep a pulse on what the actual number is until we do our official count.
Wow. Well, I know we have so many factors in our area that, you know, contribute to this problem, and right now certainly with our oil price drop, that makes us a little bit unique, and it's a great cause for concern that we might have some a rise on our homeless population, which brings us to our mental health aspect. I wonder what your clients have to share. Do they have stories? What are their fears?
Being specifically related to COVID or just general?
General.
Yeah.
Right now, at this point in time, you can pick something. There's so much going on right now.
Yeah.
We have been talking about, you know, there's COVID, and then we've got the economy, and now with all of these protests, I'm sure that all of this creates a new worries, a new sense of anxiety for our homeless population.
We definitely, within our residents, so we've got four, and when the virus happened, three of our four residents lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. So we have seen, and on top of them losing their jobs, the resources dwindled. So, you know, they couldn't go to the library to use a computer. You know, they couldn't go to Goodwill to get some job training and some vocational skill training and help with their resume. And it was just harder to apply for jobs. I know we did, one of our residents, she did get reemployed. We helped her get reemployed at a grocery store during the virus, but it was difficult. You know, her and I sat in my office and people weren't hiring and people weren't interviewing, and, you know, she's paycheck to paycheck, and there was a lot of fear of, you know, she'd just gotten into this new RV and trying to pay rent, and and there's no end in sight. And she felt that. And another one of our residents, he does a lot of contract work, and he expressed that, you know, he didn't know when that contract work was going to come back, which was oil and gas related. So, you know, that there was that a lot of job loss fear for sure.
Yeah, and I think all of that plays into, you know, your mental health or your emotional well-being is whenever you have, you know, the anxiety of not having a home. You know, do you have enough money for food? Do you have a family that you're trying to feed? You know, are you going to be safe if you're no longer in your RV, if you're back really on the street, those kind of things, you know? And, you know, I think that's whenever people worry about COVID or just about, I don't know, just being discounted in general. And all of those things, I mean, most of us have not ever had to have the fear of not having a place to stay or having enough food to eat. But those are very real fears that our community is facing, which I couldn't believe when we talked to Libby Campbell with the food bank, and she was talking about how many hungry people there were in this area. And I'm like, there's money, there's food. Why are there hungry people? So I got a real education from her. So, and I think that's what you guys are providing us and our listeners is the education on, you know, what the homeless go through on a daily basis and the fears that they do face and the worries that they do have and the insecurities.
I feel like this scenario, this situation that we're dealing with right now, our worldwide crisis on all different levels, has really connected us in a way that we could never have anticipated. And it has brought to light some of these issues that people are living with on a regular basis. So we might have a little bit of these experiences on a different level, but this is, I can't even imagine the level of panic and anxiety of what that must feel like.
Definitely escalated. Our resident that lost his contract work, I think we had just gotten him into an RV maybe a month prior to the virus starting. And, you know, so he had just gone from living in an abandoned building for a couple of years to, I've got a place to live. And then, I've lost my job. So quite a roller coaster.
Yeah, whenever you're thinking, you know, one step forward and, you know, 10 steps back, and at some point, you know, unless you're very determined, it might be very easy to just give up and say, I'm just going to live in an abandoned building for the rest of my life. So I think that's the what I'm grateful for of that you guys are providing to this community is that encouragement and that hope that we want all people to have. We don't want people to be, you know, ashamed of their situation in life because it could be any of us at some point. So, you know, people that can accept, it's not the handout. It's, you know, just like we are here to help you and we're not going to do it for you. We have, you know, protocols that you have to follow. But if you can, with our support, you're going to get to a good place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I will say that hope and encouragement that we really strive to provide for our people was really mutual in this time for me personally. Like, just as in our family, we live in a tiny home that's mobile, and eventually we'll be moving out to the village for that first missional home to live in the first group of 10 houses in this neighborhood. And our lease was up in our current location, and we were really struggling to be able to find a place to put our house. And so there was a period of time where, like, I was pretty anxious about, where am I going to live? What's this going to look like? I've got two kiddos and a baby on the way coming in September. And that was really anxious for me. And so in a lot of ways, our neighbors were able to help me through that because they're like, well, we've seen this kind of thing before. This isn't new to us to be living in sort of a survival mentality. And they actually provided a level of calm for me that was really helpful too. So I really appreciated that.
What a great teaching opportunity, because I think we're so many of us were just used to, you know, we got put into this place during isolation where it's like we never had to think about running out of items at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nothing in comparison to running out of food entirely.
Mm.
So
yeah, and we've seen a variety of statistics on, you know, on this number that I'm about to give you, but we've seen from anywhere between 50 and 70% of Americans are one paycheck from becoming homeless. And essentially what that boils down to is that they've got less than $1,000 in savings. And if something catastrophic happens, like a job loss or health issue or whatever, if they've got no one to call to get some help, they could really be in trouble. And that's the story of so many of our people. We've really done a lot of asking about, okay, well, what causes homelessness? And, you know, if you ask off the bat, we'll get an answer like, well, you know, I lost my job and I got sick, or I got in some trouble and that really kept me from getting jobs and all this other stuff. But if you drill down even further to the bottom of everybody's story, it's the fact that one of those triggers occurred and they had zero people to turn to. And that is what happens with homelessness. And then it begins this spiral where you just lose everything. And the last thing you lose is your hope. And then there you are alone and really needing some help. So that's something we've learned over the years, is that at the bottom of homelessness is complete disconnection and hopelessness, that we really, really believe that we have a way to help restore that.
Well, I think that's necessary, you know, if you, and I quote this all the time, y'all were probably tired of hearing it, but because, you know, my training is in psychotherapy, there's a hierarchy of needs that was, designed by Abraham Maslow many years ago. And once your safety needs are met, and, you know, that's what you guys are working to do, then it's a sense of belonging. And so, you know, those things are so important for us to be able to even function in society as human beings. And so you're talking about having a complete disconnect and no resources. That takes away the first two levels of the things that are completely necessary for a person to be able to function.
Mm-hmm.
So I think y'all are meeting those first two needs. And, you know, and some people that are homeless now may have had that in the past, so they know what that looks like and they can fall back on that and strive for it. But if it's truly been somebody maybe that's struggled with addiction or, you know, like a serious mental health issue, they may have never had that.
Right.
I appreciate what you guys do very, very much.
Well, we appreciate what you guys do a lot, too.
Well, thank you.
Well, I think it's such an important thing that we can all connect on. And right now, I know when you mentioned, you know, your own personal experiences, I think we all talk about this a lot, especially just because we're all surrounded in our nonprofit world, how scary it was initially. Not having any idea how, you know, especially, you know, we rely on our community to help fund our causes, and our community is suffering right now. So this has been a really eye-opening experience for so many of us, to connect with even our own clients, the people we serve. It's like it's made us all very much one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
I met not long ago with, I don't remember the exact date because it's all run together, with John Mark and Laura, and we've talked about, you know, any kind of collaboration that we can do as far as mental health and, you know, any of their neighbors, and that's something that we're definitely going to be exploring because those needs are huge, and, you know, we're hopeful that some of the funders in the area will see fit to help us with some of that, and we're going to all have to continue looking for donations, fundraising, anything to help with those kind of collaborations.
Yes. We hope that, and anyone listening, if you find it in your heart to make a donation, could you let us know how our listeners can reach out and either help volunteering or donate to your cause?
Sure. Well, we just actually launched the public phase of our capital campaign today on Facebook. So you can find us on Facebook, The Field's Edge. And then you can also go to our website. We've got a donate page on our website, www.thefieldsedge.org. And then you can always reach us by email at info@thefieldsedge.org. And we'll respond to you and answer any of your questions and get you plugged in for some volunteer opportunities if you're interested that way as well.
Yeah, and I'll put in another little plug too. So throughout this COVID pandemic, we decided to do something a little bit out of the box, and we're already a little bit out of the box anyways with tiny homes and everything else, so we just sort of embraced that. And we have two llamas that are being certified as therapy animals. My wife Brianna is the llama mama, and part of the thing we did was we thought, well, how cool would it be for all the people that are locked up in their homes and staying away from everything? And
I heard about this.
We could do a llama parade. And it started with one of my friends whose son, it was his 9th birthday. And we just heard that he was really down, that he wasn't able to have a birthday party. So we just got the llamas and trailer and drove them over there and did a little drive-by parade. And then that sort of birthed an idea for us to use that platform as a fundraising opportunity for our cleanup litter program. And so we did a deal where, you know, for a certain amount, you could, for $60, we would drive by your house with the llamas, you could pet them through the trailer, and that funded one person's wages for one day. And then up to, you know, $360 donation would get you the llamas out of the trailer, photos with your family, all that stuff, and that funded our trash program. Three workers for 2 days in a week. So that's something that we did, and we found that to be really, really awesome for those that did participate in that opportunity, just to have a little bit of joy with some llamas and pet some animals. And it was really good for us too to get out and, of course, put our masks on and stay away from people, but let them play with the animals.
Gosh, we talk about creative fundraising, but I have to say that's definitely it. I don't know. I joke about how with the way the world is right now, I wouldn't be surprised if I went to my front door and saw a pig. It would be funny to see a llama, though, and I did not know that could be happening.
Yep. Well, and that is still a possibility. So if you want the llamas, you can go to our fieldsedge.com/donate page, and there's instructions on the different levels and how you do it, and we'd be sure happy to come by your house with our llamas and give you a little joy.
I love that so much. I've got to come up with a good plan for the llama party. That's got to happen.
Yeah. I bet we'll figure something out.
Oh, definitely. We appreciate you guys so much. And as always, we want our listeners to remember that if you need help, please give Centers a call. Our website is centerstx.org, or you can contact us. Our information is all on our website, and we'll also be at the end of the episode. So thank you guys so much for participating. We learned so much, and we're excited about a possible partnership with you all.
We sure
thank
are
for
too.
The invitation.
Yeah, yes. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys. Maybe the next time we'll be in the studio with Bailey.
Yes.
That'd be perfect.
All right.
I look forward to it.
All right.
Center Solutions is a production of the Recording Library of West Texas. Post-production work is done by Bailey Hennis. Content is provided by Melanie Size and Christy Edwards. Contact Centers for Children and Families at 432-570-1084 or the Recording Library 432-682-2731. Email Melanie with questions you want answered on the show at msize@centerstexas.org. That's msize@centerstx.org. Both nonprofits are on all social media platforms. See you next time.
Our Thanksgiving series continues Thursday on the Noon Book Hour as we begin reading Thanksgiving by Janet Ivanovich. In Williamsburg, Virginia, Megan Murphy is a potter and historical greeter who ran away from her hometown to start over. She had been left at the altar by her previous fiancé. She wanted a new beginning. And now, when it comes to men, Megan Murphy has an aversion to "I do." So when she discovered a floppy-eared rabbit gnawing on the hem of her skirt, she meant to give its careless owner a piece of her mind. But Dr. Patrick Hunter was too attractive to stay mad at for long. Add in a cozy colonial cottage and the world's biggest turkey, and the two are soon making Thanksgiving dinner for their families. Thanksgiving by Janet Ivanovich, starting Thursday at noon and Friday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Because our regularly scheduled program was not available at broadcast time, we bring you the following special presentation.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience.
and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Hello, I am Herbert Gilmore, and this is Prevention Magazine. I'll be reading from the November 2020 issue. The first article is Five Myths About Holiday Eating by Kate Rockwood. The biggest misconception, that you must be vigilant about every bite during this food-filled time of the year. Myth 1, you're destined to enter 2021 in bigger jeans. Myth Buster, if you gain weight over the holidays, it's unlikely to be much. Research shows, but that doesn't mean you're imagining your tight waistband. Salty, sugary, fatty foods and alcohol cause bloating and water retention, which can make you look and feel as if you've put on a few, even if it's temporary, says Dana Angelo White, a registered dietitian and a certified athletic trainer. True weight gain is only from fat or muscle, but water weight shifts can be pretty aggressive, she says. Most of that will disappear once you resume regular healthy habits, says Don Jackson Blantner, RDN and author of The Superfood Swap. Drink plenty of water, snack on fruits and veggies, walk on your lunch breaks. You know the drill, and you'll go back to normal soon. Myth number 2. Seasonal treats are the biggest reason you overeat. Myth buster. Mom's sweet and salted pecan pie is irresistible, but it may not be the main reason you eat past the point of comfort during the holidays. The company is a big factor. We tend to eat more when we're socializing than we do when we're alone, possibly as much as 48% more. Research has found, to avoid munching unconsciously around others, tweak some of your habits instead of chatting over the cheese board. Move your conversation to a room without food, Blattner says. Rather than lingering after dessert, suggest a family walk or a game of cards if you're at a restaurant. Ask the server to take your dish away once you feel full. You can also center your get-togethers more around activities like ice skating than around food. Myth number 3. Working out extra hard can cancel out any overindulgence. Myth buster. We're sorry to say it, but you can't really sweat away those festive treats. When researchers at Texas Tech University followed people, half of whom were active, for the 6 weeks between Thanksgiving and the New Year, they found that both groups gained about the same amount of weight. More important, perceiving exercise as a way to cancel out overeating is an unhealthy mindset, Blattner says. Eating your favorite foods isn't something you should be punished for, she says. Try to mentally separate food from exercise and to embrace staying active for all its benefits beyond anything the scale may say. Squeezing in a walk or time on your yoga mat can boost your energy, improve your digestion, and help you manage stress. That's a win on multiple levels during the hectic holiday season. Myth 4. It's good to detox or fast after the new year. Making a sharp turn from sweets and stuffed meats to a juice cleanse is a setup for disaster. These highly restrictive regimens are just crash diets in disguise, Angela White says. They can wreak havoc on your metabolism and lead to overeating and rebound weight gain. And they're not necessary. Most of us lose about half of any holiday weight within a month, research published in the New England Journal of Medicine found. This is mainly because people go back to their regular eating habits, Blattner says. Losing the rest, if you want to, calls for intentionality, not misery. Meet a friend for a walk instead of a fancy coffee drink. Swap in sparkling water for wine for a while. And eat a variety of colorful produce. Such small tweaks can get the job done and are a lot easier to live with in the long term. Myth 5. You should definitely replace higher fat, higher calorie holiday foods with healthier versions. Myth buster. Sure, you can use Greek yogurt instead of mayo in your dip or less sugar in your sugar cookies recipe if it feels like a purely positive swap. But if the healthier version of your favorite holiday dish seems restrictive, depressing, or diet-like, you may wind up doing extra nibbling and snacking later in the day, Blattner says. One study found that people who bought food labels as light could eat 13% more calories than those who ate full fat versions. It's better to stick to a sensible portion of the traditional celebratory food and really savor each bite. Eating slowly and mindfully not only enables you to enjoy your food more, but also helps you to eat less of it, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Resources. That article was Five Myths About Holiday Eating by Kate Rockwood. The next article is Vote for Your Health by Merrill Davids Landau. This year, the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, your health is on the ballot. Scientific research which leads to better prevention and new treatments does not have to be partisan and has not always been so. Here's why it's important to put it at the forefront of your choices. Women have always considered many factors when voting, but this election, health care is top of mind. I say it all the time now. Vote health care. Vote health care. Vote health care, says Cindy Pearson, executive director of the National Women's Health Network, a nonprofit advocacy group in Washington, D.C. So much of our health is affected by what our elected officials do. Getting affordable insurance, contraception, and screenings depends on this, as does having access to doctors who understand the unique ways in which conditions like heart disease affect women. Reproductive rights and racial disparities in the system are likewise on the ballot. It's more important than ever that women support people who prioritize women's health, says Congresswoman Nittany Lowey, a rep from New York, who's retiring after more than 30 years. We cannot take that for granted. Legislating for women's health. In some ways, the link between government and well-being is clear. Medicare and Medicaid are federal programs that help millions of women, and we know that the Affordable Care Act, ACA, aka Obamacare, expanded insurance coverage. The ACA was particularly transformational for women, says Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, who represents the area around New Haven, Connecticut. The law eliminated co-pays for birth control, mammogram, and annual visits, made it illegal to charge women higher premiums as it had been standard practice, and forced companies to cover pre-existing conditions. Those conditions had included pregnancy, breast and ovarian cancer, osteoporosis, and more, she said. But a lot more is going on in government that concerns women's bodies. For instance, Congress directs how much the National Institutes of Health spends each year to research breast cancer, autoimmune disorders, reproductive health, and more, says Susan F. Wood, Ph.D., director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at the George Washington University School of Public Health. Sometimes elected officials make women's health a priority, as they did in the 1990s, when hundreds of millions of dollars flowed into Women's Health Initiative, WHI, a 15-year study that examined how hormone replacement therapy, diet, and certain supplements impacted postmenopausal health. When legislators don't focus on women's needs, important research such as on endometriosis, which affects 1 in 10 women, but about which little is known, goes unfunded. And it's the president who appoints the executives who run those agencies, as did George H.W. Bush when the Women's Health Initiative was started, and who nominates Supreme Court justices who decide the fate of many health laws. Choices like these are made behind closed doors and may feel distant, says Sarah Christopherson, Policy Advocacy Director for the NWHN, but the consequences can be life or death. A recent study in the women's health issues found that states that expanded Medicare under the ACA had fewer maternal deaths than those that didn't, with non-Hispanic black mothers benefiting most. Maternal mortality is one of the many areas in which black women fare worse than white ones, something elected representatives could address by funding research to understand why, Wood says. Whom we vote for affects even how new drugs are tested. It was not until the early 1990s that women in Congress made sure clinical pharmaceutical trials included women as well as men, crucial as women may metabolize drugs differently and require different dosages. I remember when all the clinical trials were done on men, even the lab rats were male, says Lowey, who worked with colleagues to insist that the NHI trials include women. Amazingly, scientists didn't need to include female animals in government-funded research until 2016. Even today, not all researchers follow the policy. A 2018 analysis, for example, found that women weren't adequately included in drug trials for heart failure and coronary artery disease, despite the fact that heart disease remains the number one killer of women. Even a single politician at the local level can make a difference, says Pearson, who points to one female state senator in California who recently pushed through a requirement that hospital staff be trained in implicit racial bias that harms women of color. Politicizing science. Having scientific evidence take a back seat to other considerations is not new. FDA officials appointed by George W. Bush, for example, prevented emergency contraception known as Plan B from being made available without a prescription, despite evidence that it would be safe. It was finally allowed to be sold partially over-the-counter as of 2006. We shouldn't have to worry that someone is influencing decisions based strictly on financial or political reasons, says Wood. But over the past decade, as partisan politics have grown even more divisive and some elected officials seem downright dismissive of science and facts, say health advocates, there has been a trend toward discounting evidence, an expert says, Michael Fernandez, director of the Center for Scientific Evidence and Public Issues at the American Association for Advancement of Science, a nonprofit advocacy group in Washington, D.C. The AAAS created in the center in 2018, he says, because decision makers too often ignore, misunderstand, or misuse relevant evidence. Elected officials can disagree, for instance, about whether companies should be required to cover birth control, but they shouldn't argue that contraception doesn't reduce the risk of unintended pregnancy, as did the Trump administration. It's fine to have a political argument, but we should at least agree that certain things are true, Fernandez says. A willingness to dismiss science was particularly evident during the current administration's response to COVID-19, DeLauro says. Officials first downplayed the reality of its rapid spread, then offered misinformation about the treatments. By summer, the U.S. had the highest number of deaths in the world, as other countries slowed the spread. Anti-science bias has also lurked behind other recent decisions. At the Environmental Protection Agency, for instance, a pending rule will allow staffers to ignore important scientific findings when crafting regulations that could impact our health, such as those affecting toxins in the air and water. Voters have a responsibility to understand not only what kinds of decisions their leaders are making, but also how they're making them and whether they're appropriately incorporating scientific evidence into their decision-making process, Fernandez says. If Congress looked different. While politicians who vote your values can be any gender, Pearson and others believe we would all benefit if more women were elected. Currently, only a quarter of U.S. House and Senate members are women. While not every female is a strong supporter of women's health, most are. And their very presence changes the agenda, DeLauro says, in part because of their personal experience. DeLauro, for instance, survived ovarian cancer, while Iowa Representative Abby Finkenauer, who suffers from endometriosis, is aiming to double funding for research on the disease. Illinois Representative Lauren Underwood is a registered nurse who has seen health disparities firsthand and is pushing for expanded health care coverage. Research has confirmed that women in Congress focus on health care issues for women, children, and men, more than do their male counterparts, says Craig Volden, Ph.D., co-director of the Center for Effective Lawmaking at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville. His research found that 65% of Congresswomen introduced bills on health, while only 40% of men did. He also found that women's bills were less likely to become law, which he speculates is because most committees and subcommittees through which agendas are set are led by men. When Lowy took over as chair of the powerful House Appropriations Committee in 2019, his spending bills contained record funding for maternal health and cancer research. So when you vote this November, please do. Think hard about the people you're supporting. You're making decisions that could directly determine the quality of health care for years to come, for your family and for you. Seven questions to ask candidates. It doesn't matter which side of the political fence you sit on. Health care is on everyone's mind for this election. In fact, a recent Gallup poll found that it was the number one concern among voters, above even the economy and national security. Before you vote, find out whether your candidates in your state are using science to inform their opinions by contacting their campaign offices and asking these questions. 1. How should the U.S. best prepare for current and future pandemics? 2. Do you believe contraceptives and reproductive health should be covered? 3. What can be done about the rising cost of health care? 4. Do you support the Affordable Care Act? If not, what will you replace it with? 5. How will you ensure that science doesn't fall victim to partisan politics? 6. What are your plans to help fund research on women's health? 7. How can the government ensure that clinical trials represent all genders and races? That article was Vote Your Health by Merrill Davids Landau. The next article is Meet Your Thymus by Adele Jackson Gibson. This disappearing organ is shrouded in mystery, but this much is clear. It plays a vital role in our immunity and how we age. 1. disease-fighting army base. If your immune cells were soldiers, your thymus, an H-shaped gland that sits between your breastbone and your heart, would be one of their boot camps. The thymus puts the T in T lymphocytes, the T cells that fight bacteria, viruses, and cancer to protect you from illness. This gland is very active in the baby years, hosting young stem cells until they mature and specialize. Some grow up to be killers that attack invaders. Some become helpers to assist the killer cells or aid antibody production. Others are the sheriffs that keep T cells from running amok. After puberty, basic training ends, and we're set with nearly all the self-reproducing T cells we need for the rest of our lives. This is why poor thymic development in childhood could lead to a weak immune system. Luckily, this is rare. 2. Now you see it. Weirdly enough, the thymus pulls a vanishing act called involution as you get older and it becomes less active. The thymus cells are replaced with fat cells and the gland shrinks. A thymus that weighs 37 grams when you're a college freshman might be only 6 grams by the time you're retired. While experts are still trying to understand why this happened, many believe the rate of shrinkage sets the pace of our immunity natural decline over time. This atrophy could be the reason we become less adaptable to new pathogens and more susceptible to cancer as we age. Researchers are now looking at ways to delay Mother Nature to bolster the thymus, but slowing down its natural shrinkage too much may increase the risk of malfunction and possible autoimmune conditions. 3. Boost your immunity. To keep your thymus humming, check your zinc levels. A deficiency in this mineral has been shown to decrease thymic activity, weaken the immune system, and cause hair loss, diarrhea, and eye or skin sores. If you're experiencing any of those symptoms, see your doctor about a blood test. You may need a supplement. Signs that your thymus isn't working right. If your eyes keep drooping, your speech is slurred, and you're getting progressively weaker throughout the day, you could have myasthenia gravis, a not-so-common condition which the thymus gland blocks the signal sent to activate your muscles. To lower the risk of thymus issues like this, focus on boosting your overall immunity through restorative sleep, a balanced diet, and regular exercise. That article was Meet Your Thymus by Adele Jackson Gibson. The next article is Natural Fixes, How a Chiropractor Treats Hip Pain by Ashley Breeding. The hip is one of the central weight-bearing joints in the human body, so pain here can throw your whole body off kilter. Discomfort may be caused by physical trauma, like a fall, or by an underlying medical condition. Chiropractic, meaning to be done by hand, is a treatment that uses manual adjustment techniques on the spine to help with both, says Robert H. Hayden, D.C., Ph.D., F.I.C.C., proprietor of Iris City Chiropractic Center in Griffin, Georgia, and spokesperson for the American Chiropractic Association. Nearly half of Hayden's patients who are over 60 have hip complaints. Here he explains how chiropractic can get the ball and socket rolling again. First, what is chiropractic? You might be surprised to learn that it's one of the largest and most regulated health care professions. Chiropractic focuses on musculoskeletal and nervous system disorders and how they affect your health. It's often used for headaches or pain in the neck, back, or joints. In a 2015 industry-funded study, patients who underwent chiropractic for spinal, hip, or shoulder pain reported less pain 4 months later than those who saw MDs. A bonus, their medical costs were also lower. How can a chiropractic help with hip pain? Doctors of chiropractic, DCs, use a variety of techniques including manual adjustments, exercises, electrotherapy, ultrasound, cold laser, and massage on knots and muscles. One of the most common procedures we perform is spinal manipulation, or chiropractic adjustment, which restores joint mobility when we manually apply a controlled force to joints that have become restricted. In many cases, we can adjust the hip joint using a painless drop table technique. The DC lightly thrusts the bone in a way that triggers a mechanism on the table the client is resting on the top to drop half an inch and gravity assists in moving the bone. This opens the joint, which creates motion and relieves pain. Deep ultrasound and on surrounding muscles, infrared sauna to heat connective tissue, and exercises or stretches can also help. Okay, what is the course of treatment like? During the first session, we usually take your medical history and do a physical exam and any necessary imaging. Chiropractic care is typically non-invasive, and though you could experience mild discomfort, you will likely feel better and function more fully afterward. Many conditions can be corrected in a single visit. Chronic conditions may require multiple sessions and regular exercise. It can take 2 or 3 weeks to start seeing results. How can I get the most out of it? Be very thorough with your history. Think of yourself as a mystery novel that needs to be unfolded in detail. Write down your meds and significant points of your medical history, information about prior injuries, athletic activity, and any impacts on your job, on the hip, are especially important. Explain where the pain radiates when and where it goes, as well as what makes it feel better or worse. Tell your DC about your daily routine and how the conditions affect your ability to function. These things are important because our goal is to restore your function. That article was Natural Fixes, How a Chiropractor Treats Hip Pain by Ashley Breeding. The next article is Natural Benefits of Parsley by Erica Ellen Sansone. This leafy herb is more than a pretty garnish. Found in flat and curvy varieties, parsley is packed with antioxidants such as flavonoids, carotenoids, and vitamins A, C, and K. Its anti-inflammatory properties can also aid digestion and soothe gastrointestinal upset, says Signe Porquet, ND, a resident at National University of Natural Medicine Health Centers in Portland, Oregon. Try one of our favorite remedies. Antioxidant salsa. Top dishes like eggs, potatoes, fish, and salad with this bright lemony dressing. A cinch to make it packs a healthy punch. Combine one bunch of finely chopped parsley leaves, 2 teaspoons of lemon zest, 1 clove of garlic minced, 2/3 cup of olive oil, and 2 tablespoons red wine vinegar. Add salt to taste. Gentle detox. Whip up this refreshing low-calorie beverage full of antioxidants and vitamins for a morning wake-up or an afternoon snack. Chop 1/2 cup of parsley leaves, no stems, 1 medium apple, cored, 1/2 lemon peeled and seeded, and 1-inch piece of ginger peeled, 1 small whole cucumber, 2 stalks of celery. Place in a blender and blend well. Add up to 1 cup of water for smoothness. Strain through a fine mesh sieve to remove solids and pour into a glass over ice. Tummy smoother. This recipe is great for an upset stomach or when you're feeling under the weather and need something mild to digest. Put 3 6-inch long zucchini, chopped, 3 stalks celery, chopped, 1 pound green beans, and 1 to 2 cloves of garlic, optional, in 4 cups water in a saucepan. Bring to boil, then reduce heat and simmer. Covered, 15 minutes. Add 1 to 2 bunches parsley leaves, approximately 2 cups, and puree with an immersion blender. Add salt and pepper to taste. Drink hot. Keep 2 days in the fridge. That article was Natural Benefits of Parsley by Erica Ellen Sansone. The next article is The ER, To Go or Not to Go by Holly Pevsner. The pandemic may have made you second guess a trip to the emergency room, and in some cases that might be a good thing. I'm happy when families don't rush to the ER for conditions that can be treated in a primary care, like ear infections, pink eye, strep throat, and rashes, says Katie Lockwood, MD, an attending physician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. But because true emergencies still require an ER, here's how to make the best, safest decision for your family. 1. Fever. Families often bring kids to the ER for fevers, but it's usually not necessary, says C. Anthony Lim, MD, Director of Pediatric Emergency Medicine at Mount Sinai Health System in New York City. I tell parents to monitor symptoms and use Motrin or Tylenol if needed. However, you should go to the ER if your baby is less than 2 months old and has a fever of 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit or more. Seek swift help if a child of any age has a severe neck, abdominal, or headache pain with a fever. Call a pediatrician or urgent care if the fever lasts more than 3 days or is accompanied by vomiting or the fever lowers but your child is listless. Be aware, though, that in general, urgent care centers are less equipped for pediatric conditions, says Dr. Lim. Call your pediatrician first Also, call the doc if you know that your kid recently was exposed to COVID-19 or traveled to a COVID-19 hotspot. 2. Vomiting and diarrhea. Vomiting and diarrhea are most often symptoms of a stomach bug or a mild case of food poisoning that can be dealt with safely in the comfort of your home. However, you should go to the ER if your child shows signs of dehydration, such as lack of tears, dry lips, or decreased urine output. With a baby, keep an eye out for fewer than 3 wet diapers in a day or sunken fontanelle soft spot. If vomiting occurs following a head injury or the child is throwing up blood, go to the ER, says Dr. Lim. Call the pediatrician if your child also has persistent abdominal pain, especially if it drifts from the midsection to the lower right abdomen, a sign of appendicitis. Additionally, reach out if they have bloody stool or a high fever, more than 102 degrees Fahrenheit, if they can't keep down clear liquids or symptoms intensify. Burns or other injuries, 3. These can be sudden or scary. Go to the ER if your child has lost consciousness, experienced persistent vomiting, or intense headache, or an injury. Large burns, obvious broken bones or neck injuries, or animal bites on the face or hands also require an ER visit. That's all the time we have for that article, and that was The ER, To Go or Not to Go by Holly Pavsner. That concludes today's reading from the November 2020 issue of Prevention Magazine. This has been Herbert Gilmore.